It's round three for Jacksonville's human rights ordinance. The new year starts off with a rash of more shootings and more problems for former public defender Matt Shirk. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our first Friday roundtable of the new year. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a preview of this weekend's concert and CD release party from Sultans of String. All of that and more ahead. But first, Friday it is. Time to look at the top stories of the week and a busy news week to discuss as we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, everybody.
Good to see you. Claire Goforth, editor at Folio Weekly, is here.
Good morning.
Our own WJCT analyst, John Burr, with us in studio.
Hey there.
And our own WJCT reporter, Ryan Bank.
Good morning.
Thanks, guys, everyone, for being here. Lots to discuss, from a rash of shootings, including shootings that upset folks at Art Walk downtown this week. Amazon bringing more jobs to town, more problems for former public defender Matt Shirk, all of that ahead. But our top story this morning, hoping that the third time will be the charm, a bipartisan group of three Jacksonville City Councilmen have introduced an amendment to the city's human rights ordinance once again to expand protections to Jacksonville's LGBT community. This is the third attempt, I said, to expand the law. Council vetoed the first version back in 2012, and a sponsor, Tommy Hazuri, withdrew a similar bill last year to fine-tune the legislation. The new anti-discrimination bill is shorter than previous drafts, but it will still basically accomplish the same thing: protect LGBT citizens from discrimination in the areas of jobs, housing, and public accommodations. We want your calls as we discuss this third attempt to expand the HRO in Jacksonville. What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet the show, weigh in on Facebook. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. We just got an email a minute ago from the Jacksonville Coalition for Equality saying that they will pack the City Hall chambers next Tuesday at 5 p.m. when lawmakers hold their first public comment session on this matter. It'll be a first reading of this new bill.
Well, if there's one thing that we can predict, is it will be full council chambers again for this debate. That's about all you can really predict with certainty. And I'm sure it's going to have a lot of strong voices on either side once again.
Now, City Councilman Aaron Bowman is a co-sponsor of this bill. He says he won't take the T for transgender out of the LGBT acronym to get more council votes to vote this into law. Let's listen to Aaron Bowman quickly.
Certainly wouldn't be something that I would offer up. I don't know personally how you decide one group is worth discriminating, the other one isn't. To me, everybody needs to be treated with respect. And as a Navy man for 32 years, I went out every day and supported and defended everybody, not people I just chose.
Claire Goforth, it's been surmised that there might be some council persons who would vote for this, if not for the T, which stands for transgender citizens. We're hearing there's still some resistance to passing these protections for the small transgender community in this city.
Yeah, the reality is that the transgender community in this city and nationwide are some of the most vulnerable citizens that live in this county. Removing the T may be politically popular, but for the long term, what we've seen is that when they say, well, this time, let's just get the LGB community protected, what happens is it never comes back to council. And the transgender citizens who are the most vulnerable continue to face discrimination in their homes and workplaces.
We want your calls on this third attempt to pass Jacksonville's human rights ordinance. The number to join us, 549-2937. There will be vocal opponents once again speaking out against this legislation, like Jacksonville resident Frederick Wilson. He tells WJCT the gender identity section is a problem for him because business owners, he says, won't know if someone is sincere.
I'm more conservative. I think men should look like men, traditional dress. Women should look like women, traditional dress. And for someone to come and tell me now that they don't have to, I don't like that.
Ryan Bank.
So I think the first thing that we have to remember is we have to place this this idea of removing the T out of an HRO in its historical context. And there has been within the LGBT community a massive split between lesbian and gay and bisexual people and gender nonconforming people like transgender people. And the reason being is someone's sexual orientation isn't necessarily something that has to be expressed outwardly. They can still dress traditionally masculine or feminine, with some variations, of course. Whereas a trans person, their identity hinges upon the fact that their outward sex does not comport with the way they feel inside. And so the way that they remedy that is by dressing like the gender that they feel that they are inside, that they are psychologically. So I think that this is a strategy of divide and conquer, and that this would be used by opponents to engage in an age-old division within the community. And this is going as far back as, you know, Harvey Milk. I mean, this is something that has always happened.
The martyred gay activist in San Francisco, first gay man to hold public office in America. Now, the HRO bill, here's the language on this, John Burr. It defines gender identity as a person's consistent, sincere assertion of a particular gender identity, appearance, or expression, or by any other evidence that a person's gender identity is sincerely held. The Jacksonville Chamber of Commerce, other business leaders are strongly pushing that the council pass this. They've seen what happened in North Carolina when a measure there called HB2, also known as the bathroom bill, which would mandate that people use public bathrooms corresponding with their anatomy, not their gender identity. That became very controversial. The state of North Carolina lost many millions of dollars in business and jobs expansion. So it's interesting to watch social conservatives squaring off against business leaders once again here in Jacksonville over this.
Yeah, and the business leaders are really going to tip the balance, I think. And I think it will pass this time. I think the HRO will pass this time. But, you know, the business community has been in favor of this the first two times. But, you know, they really didn't fight it that hard. It was more the gay and transgender community that really came out in support. So I think that's going to change this time. Bowman is part of the Chamber of Commerce, and I think the business community is going to get much more involved, and that's going to be the difference.
There are also some exemptions carved out, David Bauerline, for local religious institutions and businesses with fewer than 15 employees, we need to point out.
Right, and I think the fewer than 15 employers is a very standard part of a lot of these types of anti-discrimination laws. The carve-outs for religious institutions, that is going to be a lot of debate in terms of where that line is drawn, at what point the religious institution falls into a public accommodation and should be treated as if they were not faith-based.
Yeah, we can't underestimate the ability of the religious community to push back against the HRO, which they have done again and again. The past two times we saw a very concentrated effort. First Baptist Church was part of it. They had that press conference that was quite memorable. And the national interest that they brought in, the national representatives who came in to present their side of this debate that, no, we should be allowed to discriminate against people on the basis of who they have a romantic relationship with and what they wear.
I have to say, though, I think we need to mention that there has been some evidence that may suggest that the business argument is not necessarily a winning strategy for pro-LGBT activists. If you look at what happened in North Carolina, they didn't even get the repeal that they wanted. And even if they were going to go forward with that repeal of HB2, they were going to have to let go of some protections, citywide protections. So I really think the problem here, and some other reporters in town here have alluded to this, is the strategy for activists hasn't been a winning strategy. Even the business community, the problem is that they have too many contradictory positions. They are aligned with certain segments of our public officials who do not agree with this HRO expansion, and who in fact they need to push other parts of their business agenda. So we're really not looking at anything that that seems to be different this time around. I mean, to John's point, I would have to kind of disagree. I don't think that there's really that much hope that this is going to pass the third time around.
You think it will fail?
I think as of right now, as early as it is, it seems like everything is in the same place it was when the last bill was introduced and when the bill before that in 2012 was introduced. Unless they change their strategy going forward, unless, to be quite honest, they're a little bit more forceful, I don't see how they're going to accomplish anything.
All right. We want your calls on the top stories of the week. What do you think about the third attempt in Jacksonville to pass an updated human rights ordinance? 549-2937. Let's go to John on the north side now. Hi, John. Happy Friday.
Thank you for accepting my call. My position on this is I don't think it's about Christians or how much money the city is going to lose. It's about common sense. It's about so many go both ways. Gay people who got children by the same sex they are and the opposite sex by the opposite sex. So you got no guarantee of who's going to be going in the bathroom with your wife. And that's my concern. And I think that the people of Jacksonville have been very smart so far, and they need to stay that way. This do not need to pass.
All right. Thanks, John. Claire.
Well, I mean, I hear what he's saying, and it is a point that a lot of people have raised, but the reality is that sexual assault and sexual misconduct remains illegal, and the police will investigate and enforce any such incidents. And beyond that, I have never heard of any actual case of a person pretending to be a transgender individual going into a bathroom specifically to prey on young people, women, or men for that matter.
Yeah, there haven't been any reported instances of it.
That just doesn't happen.
In the states where this is... And to be clear, we do remain the largest city in America, the largest metro in America, that has not updated its ordinance in this manner.
And I think you look at nationwide statistics, a trans person is probably more likely to be attacked in the bathroom than a non-trans person. And the only recent incident in a bathroom that I can think about where somebody said they were trans when they weren't was an actual anti-LGBT activist who was trying to prove a point in a Target. So I think that, you know, everybody can have their opinions and their sincerely held beliefs, but at the end of the day, you have to look at the facts on paper.
Yeah, and if you require transgender individuals to use the bathroom that doesn't conform with their gender identity, you are especially setting them up for situations in which they could be assaulted or otherwise abused.
This fear over bathrooms, particularly women and girls being vulnerable in the bathroom, this is something that comes up again and again, not just in Jacksonville, but we also saw a measure like this be reversed in Houston, Texas, because of these types of fears.
And North Carolina.
And in North Carolina.
Yeah, it's a complete red herring. And it's been used by the opponents as a scare tactic. And, you know, like it's been said, you really can't point to any historical pattern of this type of thing happening.
Yeah.
You know, it's unfortunate. But, has won the day. It has won the day here and elsewhere.
The women are most vulnerable to sexual assault in their own homes. That's reality.
Let's go to Tracy in Mandarin now. Hi, Tracy. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Maybe there should be three bathrooms, one for women, one for men, and one for transgender, and have a heavy-duty CC camera in the bathroom to avoid all this nonsense, this abuse and that abuse. I will take myself off the air. Love your program. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, the plumbing industry is going to love that. So there's going to be a lot more bathrooms built.
Well, that's true. But let's be clear. This is the third time this has come around. And if you want to weigh in on this, as we said, David, you can come on out next Tuesday night when they have the first reading of the bill. Right. And there are certain to be a strong cohort of pro and anti groups making their presence known.
Right. And there's at this point, there are three co-sponsors for the bill. So there's a long way from getting to the 10. I would probably handicap it differently from Ryan and more like John, which I do think it'll pass.
Well, you think about the optics of it failing three times in a row. Is that something that these right. council members want to be known for and remembered for?
Right. And I do think on the business side of things that Yes, it's one thing what North Carolina has gone through, and that sends a certain message about how taking a position can cause a image of a state, in that case, to be fixed negatively in terms of business recruitment. But what we're hearing is basically that when people are interested in Jacksonville and they go meet with the chamber, they have a matrix of questions they ask, and this is one of them. And so it's not a question that's going away. It's a question that's going to become more and more part of the selection process. It's not the criteria, but it's one of many. And I think that's something that can sway a fence-sitting councilman or woman to support it this time around.
All right. And let's take we'll go ahead, Ryan, and then we'll take one more call.
I just wanted to mention that there are even pro-gay businesses that are still coming to town regardless of whether or not we have an HRO.
I mean,
look at IKEA, look at Amazon,
yeah.
Look at even the big banks that are in town, Deutsche Bank and all these.
They all have
company policies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's obviously not stopping them from doing business.
All right. Let's go to Lori on the west side. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi, this is kind of a late suggestion, but I'm hoping City Council is listening and they will open the bill for comments like the CFTC does for a matter of time, so that people who don't show up to the meetings can still have a voice and can be counted, and that would make it much more efficient and give a lot more people a platform to comment on, like on Facebook, or even on the COJ website. They could open a discuss comment page for all those comments to be collected, maybe.
Thanks, Lori. You know, the last time around, Mayor Curry held a series of community forums on this matter as a way to try to open the discussion up to as big a group as possible. But certainly, that's a good suggestion. Actually, let's take one more call. Chip in St. Augustine. Hi, Chip.
Hey, good morning. I think maybe a quick and easy solution to a lot of the bathroom problems would be to make all single-use bathrooms, like, you know, at McDonald's and restaurants and stuff, unisex. They all have a lock on the door. Go in, lock the door. You're by yourself. Come out, open the door. It probably would reduce waiting lines, you know, in certain situations where women always line up at the bathroom because they take a little longer. You know, it might solve a couple of problems. And then the other thing is to put real education out there as to the reality of people, you know, going in and preying on other people in other bathrooms. It just doesn't happen. It's like voter fraud. It's another, you know, smoke screen, something to get the right fired up so that they'll all stick together and vote the wrong people into office.
Chip, thanks. You know, some businesses have converted to that kind of facility, unisex bathrooms. Like, yeah. not everybody, but you do see that more often.
But, you know, here's the problem. Say in a stadium or a theater where you've got numerous people wanting to go to the bathroom at the same time, that's not going to work, one person at a time.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, it's our biggest stories of the week with our first Friday Media Roundtable of 2017. The number to join us, 549-2937. Also making headlines this week, disturbingly, two teenagers were shot Wednesday during a crowded first art walk of the year in downtown Jacksonville. The crowd went scrambling for cover on both sides of Laura Street when the shots rang out. So far, 2017 looking a lot like 2016 when it comes to the scourge of gun violence in this city. Two people were shot to death on Sunday in Springfield, and there have been at least three other shootings around town since New Year's Day. David Bauerlein, it was a 16 and a 17-year-old boy, both shot around 9:25 p.m. Wednesday night in the 100 block of North Laura Street, right in the middle of the Art Walk festivities.
Right, and that certainly is the last thing that an event like Art Walk in downtown needs, because there's been this perception, and surveys have shown that a majority of people, when asked about downtown, don't consider it safe. And statistically, that's not the case. But an event like this, where it really is designed to give people a comfort zone to come down and experience downtown, and then have a shooting like this happen, as people are leaving Art Walk or continue to enjoy being downtown after a night out, that's really a tough thing for downtown and its image. And so I think they're doing the right thing, which is they're saying we're going to come back and we're going to keep doing it and
sure.
we're going to do it better than ever.
But they've got to overcome this perception. You know, Claire, we had Sheriff Mike Williams pointing out over 13 years and some 150 art walks, it's always been safe until this incident. The statistics are on the side of that argument. But the public perception is a problem.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, I've been going to Art Walk for years, and I've never felt anything but safe. And one point that needs to be made is that this wasn't a random shooting. It did sound as though there was the two victims were involved with the shooter in some fashion. Mike Williams, I believe, suggested that there may have been some sort of drug deal going on or something of that nature. So it's not as though a random shooter just came out at Art Walk. I do think that the Downtown Vision and others are taking the right approach. They're going to have more officers there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, downtown is a very safe area. I've worked downtown for a decade, never had any problems. There's crime in all areas of Jacksonville. And, you know, the areas surrounding downtown have higher crime rates. And this may be some type of spillover from that. But I do think that Art Walk remains safe and they're taking the necessary steps.
Yeah. And going beyond downtown, there is a continuing gun violence problem in this city. This is nothing new. This is something that Jacksonville has been trying to address for how many years now?
Oh, my goodness.
This is something that continues to plague this metro and many others, to be fair.
Well, yes. It's interesting that this incident with two teenagers involved in a shooting is getting so much play, and simply because of the time and the place where it occurred. What most people probably don't realize is this is not an unusual incident for the city of Jacksonville as a whole. I mean,
yeah, there are kids getting shot all the time.
These types of shootings happen not downtown, but in other neighborhoods, you know, routinely.
Yeah, and they don't get as much attention, sadly. But yeah, this is happening with regularity.
Yeah. I mean, Florida Georgia Weekend remains very popular, and it's had many incidents of violence over the years.
Now, Mayor Curry campaigned on a public safety platform, David. He pledged to bring back with full force the anti-crime initiative, the Jacksonville Journey. They've tried to revive some of those anti-violence prevention programs, particularly targeted at young people. It's not funded nearly to the degree it was when it first launched under the John Payton mayoral administration. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to know at this point whether those types of initiatives, after school programs and all sorts of other things, are really going to have the kind of impact that everyone, I think, is hoping they will have.
And certainly not as fast as a one-year turnaround. A lot of these things are deep-rooted, systemic. There's a lot of work that would need to be done to really, truly turn that tide. And, there was a New Year's Day shooting, and some reporters asked a neighbor about it and said, "Do you feel like this is a bad neighborhood?" He said, "No, I wouldn't call it a bad neighborhood. It's a bad city." Well, that's become the problem, which is that Jacksonville is just known as a city that has this unacceptably high level of gun violence. And,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, I made a documentary film about this going back to 2008, almost a decade ago, and all of the issues are exactly the same now.
Right.
Yeah, the needle has not moved.
And the gun violence stems from the drug trade in this town. These two young people, judging what the Times Union was reporting this morning, what was on their Facebook page, the fact that they're not cooperating with the police, seems pretty clear they were involved in some illegal activity, probably drugs. And, you know, the drug trade in this town is what fuels a lot of this gunplay.
I mean, it goes back to the systemic issues. If you don't solve the foundational issues here that breed poverty and economic disenfranchisement and loose controls on guns and things of this nature, if you don't solve the reasons why people move to illegal activity to make a buck, then you're not really going to solve the violence problem.
If you're just tuning in, we want your calls as we discuss the top stories of the week, our first Friday media roundtable of the new year. The number to join us, 549-2937. Well, Jacksonville has a new public defender, Charles Cofer, former judge. His predecessor, Matt Shirk, continues to have some problems. The former public defender is under fire as the Florida Bar Association began a disciplinary investigation this week into Shirk's actions while in office. They could not do this while he was still an office holder, but now they can. There were several scandals, including alleged violations of attorney-client privilege to questionable hiring practices and relationships with employees. Can Matt Shirk come out of this, and can he find another job, given the scandals now attached to his name? As this is going on, meanwhile, the new public defender, Charles Cofer, has sort of changed the staffing around in the public defender's office and says he's working to restore the community's trust. David Barreline, what do you think?
Well, I think Charles Cofer has a lot of work to do in that regard. And Matt Shirk's time in Jacksonville has been sort of a model of what you don't want to see happen when someone is elected to an office. And obviously, Jacksonville may feel like Matt Shirk is moving on. Obviously, it sounds like there's still more shoes to drop in terms of Matt Shirk's time here. And I'm not sure what the bar would or could do, but it does sound like they're serious about it.
No, they could disbar him, and they could publicly shame him, which is one of their ways of punishment. I think that as far as the shower and the inappropriate relations with employees, those may not bite him as hard as the violation of attorney-client privilege in the Christian Fernandez case. That is going to be the one that is most likely to see him get some sort of sanction or disbarment.
Yeah, no matter how many times he showers, he's not going to shake off this dirt, and I think his time is pretty much done, but
you hire Matt Shirk?
Going beyond Ryan's jokes, the allegation that he violated attorney-client privilege for attorneys, that's such a bedrock tenet of their profession that I think Claire is right. That is by far probably the most serious allegation. People need to know that an attorney will not violate their confidentiality.
From a legal point of view, yes, it is the most serious. I think the charges about, well, he admitted to all the dalliances with his employees is probably what cost him the office and at the polls.
It's what grabbed the public's attention more, I think. But I do think
if you're Matt Shirk and you're trying to get a job at a law firm now,
forget about it.
That's going to be difficult for him.
Who's going to hire Matt Shirk?
All right, let's go to Kevin in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Kevin.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Doing okay, thanks. Thanks for calling.
I want to just comment, you guys were talking about the shootings on Wednesday, and you had referenced, first of all, you referenced a great documentary you did on 904, which was remarkable. But I think it was also the fact that, when the Peyton administration, when we talked about having over $30 million, it was on Jack's journey, they had done some studies and looked at the numbers, and for, I think, 4 or 5 years, the gun violence, the shootings dropped, incidents of kids, attending school, all those numbers were dramatically better. And I think we've gone through this, pushing this rock up the hill in Jacksonville for years now. And I think it's just a matter of when are we going to be willing to invest, in our community. And that's what, we can afford scoreboards and some of the things in the city that are important. But I think we've got to get to the point of making the decision that politically this is an investment we need to make.
And is this Kevin Gay of Operation New Hope? I think I recognize your voice.
It might be.
Thanks for calling, Kevin. Of course, Operation New Hope does incredible work in this community, helping ex-offenders find jobs after they leave the prison system. That was a big part of the Jacksonville journey initially. And he's right. They were starting to see some improvement in these numbers way back when they first launched this initiative. But then it sort of, with the housing crash, with political changes, it all sort of got put on the back burner.
And a lot of the money was from outside the city. They got a lot of grant money, which was time limited. And then so there was a big surge. You hear that word a lot in terms of military conflicts. There was a surge, then the surge pulled back, and things kind of went back to the way they were
before.
And
his argument is this needs a sustained surge over a period of many years, and the political will there to do that?
Speaking of political will, it was a Democrat, Alvin Brown, who really cut back on the program and kind of gutted it. I couldn't agree more. I mean, this is this is something that we have to get serious about, and serious means serious over time.
Yeah, you have to give people opportunities. You have to give them education. You have to give them something to do. You have to give them hope. And that's pretty much the only way that you're going to see a sustained effort to solve some of these problems.
Speaking of opportunities, also making news this week, Amazon confirmed it has plans for a second fulfillment center in Jacksonville. They're going to add more than 1,000 full-time jobs. This will be over at the Cecil Commerce Center on the west side. They're already planning to open another 1 million square foot fulfillment center on the north side. So Amazon bringing now a total of some 2,500 jobs to town. Claire Goforth, only 500 of those are expected to pay a middle class salary, $50,000 a year. The rest will be in the 12 to 15 an hour range, just above minimum wage.
Yes, I urge everyone to read Dr. David Jaffe's recent piece in Folio Weekly about Amazon and the reality of working for a fulfillment center, which is a fancy word for a sweatshop, because people who work there, you read the news reports, they're all out there, and they describe these conditions as the worst place you'll ever work. The heat is unbearable, the quotas are almost impossible to achieve, and you're being watched via electronic monitoring 24/7. While you're at work. Mm-hmm. Jobs are popular for politicians to talk about, but the reality is these are 2,500, maybe 2,000, if 500 of the jobs are actually management, of the worst jobs you'll ever have.
And the part of the Amazon phenomenon is there's going to be a lot less jobs at Nordstrom's and Macy's and department stores because, you know, if you read what's going on Wall Street, those guys are going down. They're losing all their business to Amazon and online.
And small business.
I mean, yeah, Sears, the public's desire for
automation.
Online retail and something delivered to your door right away, there is a price to pay for that. And what you're saying, that's the price.
That's the price.
Right. And Claire was talking about the piece by David Jaffries.
Jaffe.
The part about the quotas and the idea that you're constantly being expected to do more and more and almost in a robotic way. That was a little eye-opening in terms of some of the first-person accounts there. Now, having said that, look, I mean, if you're living in Northwest Jacksonville or some of these areas where jobs are hard to come by, maybe that's a good way to get a job, get your start, move up from it. But it certainly was an eye-opener from the standpoint that
David,
this is
you
not.
David, you used the magic word, robotic way, and I think in 5 or 10 years, a lot of these jobs that pay
will be automated.
That's mm-hmm.
So those exactly. 1,000 jobs won't be around that long.
Right.
We'll continue to follow that, of course, right here on this program. But finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do librarians invent patrons. Yes, to keep infrequently used books on the shelves, two Sorrento librarians created a fictitious person who was checking them out. The Orlando Sentinel reports Chuck Finley, not the former baseball pitcher, checked out over 2,300 books at the East Lake County Library in a 9-month period. His selections ranged from Steinbeck's Cannery Row to a children's book called Why Do My Ears Pop? The goal behind creating Finley as a fake person was to ensure that certain books stayed in the library. Books that aren't used for a long period can be discarded and removed from the library system.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that.
I understand their motivation, but anyway, an investigation by the Lake County Clerk of Courts Inspector General's office concluded Finley was a fake. Only in Florida is a woman arrested for assaulting her boyfriend with a roller skate. Police say 37-year-old Danelle Howard of Eustis was arrested Monday for repeatedly punching her boyfriend, then breaking the skate over his head. Police say they found a roller skate wheel and other broken property at the scene, giving a new meaning to...
Oh, no.
I won't say. Thank you to our panel, David Bauerlein, Claire Goforth, John Burr, and Ryan Bank. Thanks, guys, and Happy New Year. Thanks for being here.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
We'll be right back.
Something for me. Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, the first Friday news roundup of the year. Congress is fighting over repealing or rescuing the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. Intelligence agencies released their first report on Russian election hacking. Donald Trump says he still has doubts. And why are some folks telling the Radio City Rockettes to just shut up and dance? Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next episode of Hometown, veteran skydiver Art Schaefer takes us on a thrilling adventure at Skydive Palatka. Kathy Godwin serves up clean foods for the health conscious and people with digestive diseases at Kathy's Table. Artist Ursula Joseph sculpts lifelike dolls using polymer clay. And photography student Lucas Stanley explores ancient art through modern photography. Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we're heading to Panama with pianist Danilo Perez.
There is a history here of jazz that is being forgotten. Panama was jazz. Panama was a connection with New Orleans from the early times. It's a hidden treasure.
Music and stories from the 2016 Panama Jazz Festival. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to enjoy some farm-to-table deliciousness. It's a local chef-tasting competition with more than a dozen local restaurants and drink makers. Farm to Future is a culinary competition to help bring back local food one farmer at a time. Angela Tenbrook is the founder of Traders Hill Farm. She's here to tell us more about this. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for being here. Now, you're also the founder of the Center for Sustainable Agricultural Education and Conservation here on the First Coast. The farm-to-table and sustainable movement is a really come to this area in a big way. So farm-to-future sounds amazing. This is a culinary competition. So what's going to be happening?
So basically, we have a few local chefs who are that are pretty involved in the local food movement. And we have encouraged them to kind of come and work together for a good cause. Mm-hmm. And the cause being the Farm to Future, that the farmers, the center's event for farming. Basically, what we try to do is we try to help start new farms mm-hmm. with education and such. And so the Farm to Future event will be kind of a culinary event to with a bit of a festive, fun thing at the Glass Factory. So a reuse.
That's in St. Augustine.
No, it's in downtown Jacksonville, actually.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I don't know how I screwed that up. I've never been. And this is at 601 North Myrtle.
Yes, and actually okay. It's a really cool place. It's a reuse of the old Glass Factory on Myrtle. And we're going to put about 14 different restaurant and chefs combos, for instance, the guys at Omni Plantation or chef over there at Beebe's. And they're going to put together with a local farm some pretty good, recipes that they're getting from local farmers.
Okay, now, and here are some of the restaurants that will be on hand. Everyone from Beebe's to Biscotti's, Olio Market, Cafe Nola, Omni Amelia Island Plantation, Orsay, Community Loaves, Black Sheep possibly coming, Culhane's Irish Pub, some of the best chefs in town, all coming out to this. And this benefits the Center for Sustainable Agricultural Education. Now, are they going to be challenged in a tight time frame? Will it be like Top Chef, Food Network show?
Will it's they be not like- quite like that. It's kind of a fun, easygoing. The guys have all decided, our guys and gals have all decided to kind of work together for this good cause. You can get these tickets at 904 tickets at Farm to Future. That's 904 TIX at Farm to Future. It's kind of a fun event. There's going to be a drink category and an appetizer. So we have people like like some of the locals, like Southern Roots and people like that, who are doing some interesting stuff, because, you know, they're a vegan restaurant, and that are going to farm, you know, pair with their local farm table people and local farmers, and kind of put this fun event on.
This is so cool, because the farm-to-table culinary movement has really grown in recent years. This is a whole new generation of local farmers, of which you are one. You're the founder of Traders Hill Farm. You distribute produce all over the area. Mm-hmm. What drew you to this?
Yeah, so we farm differently, and sustainable farming is in a really important piece of farming. So many people think of farming as, you know, you're going out there and you just put the stuff in the field and you harvest it in 3 or 4 months, and, you know, sustainable farming for us is we harvest every week, and we harvest on demand. So we don't use ground, you know, the amount of ground that a traditional farm would use. That, for instance, at our farm, we are an aquaponics farm, so we farm inside a controlled environment, and we're able to farm in our 1.5 acres of undercover. We're able to farm 50 land equivalent acres. So we save water, we save land, it's a reuse. So you have your other farmers in the community who, like, for instance, Mr. Bacon, who is joining mm-hmm. us at the event, as well as Urban Folk Farm, Seminole Pride, and a variety of other farmers who all are interested in sustainable down-to-earth, with Brian Lipinski and that guy, those guys. And you have folks like Chef Kurt DiRuzio, who is involved with the Slow Food organization.
Slow Food First Coast.
That's right, Slow Food First Coast. We were just awarded that, and there's a lot of less local
farmers.
You got
their snail of approval, I think is what they call it.
Yes, it's snail of approval. It's such a fun group. And, you know, they really recognize, that's an international group, they really recognize, you know, the work of farmers and restaurants that farmed, that kind of pair together. So us at Traders Hill Farms, we're kind of excited about, you know, being involved in this, but as well the fact that we're able to, with this nonprofit, help our fellows. So many times with the new Food Safety Modernization Act, we have to have farmer education, and the fact that farmer education is very expensive. And so the center offsets some of those prices. So when you help the center in doing this Farm to Future event, you're actually helping future farmers. So, like, for instance, the center just put a new facility at West Nassau High School, and so that the biotechnical agriculture students could learn a futuristic way of farming. And we pair with other schools to do education and so forth, because if we do not encourage young people to join the farming movement, we will not have farms in the future.
Yeah. And where are we going to get our produce?
Well,
exactly.
In America, our backup plan is other countries. And so what we're trying to encourage is many young local farmers starting and getting and start involved in farming in such a way that it's sustainable, that it's good for the earth, that it's good for everybody. Every time you buy from us local farmers, you put local people to work. Mm-hmm. At our farm, it's almost primarily all women. And so you put a whole bunch of moms to work. Hey, that's good stuff.
It's good for the economy, and it's good for our health to eat locally produced agriculture that's produced in this way. So Farm to Future is going to be so much fun. You need to come on out next Tuesday night, 5:30 p.m., to the Glass Factory. That's at 601 North Myrtle. Some of the best chefs and drink makers in town will be part of this. It's going to be a delicious night, and it benefits the Center for Sustainable Agricultural Education and Conservation, the great local magazine Edible Northeast Florida, the media sponsor of this. Angela Tenbrook of Traders Hill Farm, have a great time, and thanks for sharing this with us.
Thanks. Please find your tickets at 904tix.com, Farm to Future.
And in a moment, the music of Sultans of String. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Did your family gathering this holiday involve arguing over climate change? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we'll talk about the best evidence to sway a global warming skeptic. Plus, physicist, now Congressman Dr. Bill Foster, talks about robots taking over jobs. And a trip to Gadget Nirvana, the Consumer Electronics Show. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
We think we're slick. Think nobody knows. Think there's a demarcation between secret us and public us. Not likely. On the next Snap Judgment, sex, lies, and audio tape. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, you're listening to Sultans of String with a new CD hitting number one across Canada on world music charts. Thrilling audiences with their genre-hopping passport of Celtic, flamenco, gypsy jazz, Arabic, Cuban, and South Asian rhythms. This group celebrates musical fusion and human creativity with warmth and virtuosity. Check out Sultans of String next week at Jacksonville's Mudville Music Room. Band leader and violinist Chris McCool is on the line with a preview. Hey, Chris.
Hello. How are you today?
Great, thanks. Thanks for coming out. You'll be performing at Mudville on Beach Boulevard January 11th. You've got a new release out, Subcontinental Drift. Tell us about it.
Oh, it's a really fun project. We teamed up with a sitar player who is deeply ensconced in traditional Indian music, but then teamed up his music with our music, which is a whole mixture of styles from North America and around the globe, gypsy jazz from Eastern Europe, Arabic rhythms, Cuban rhythms, East Coast Celtic fiddling. We throw it all into a big old pot and push puree, and out come Sultans of String.
Very nice. And what inspired you to sort of mash up all these musical styles?
Well, I think the Toronto music scene where we're from is very diverse. There's people from all around the globe that come to Toronto, and with them they bring their music. And so it's pretty much impossible not to have a lot of sort of collaborations going on all the time. And for me, like, we write songs about people we care about and places we've been. They're actually stories in a way. And so to have this broad palette of musical colors to choose from is a lot of fun.
Now, you're based in Toronto, as you said. You are highly celebrated up in Canada with Juno nominations. That's Canada's equivalent of the Grammys. 3 Canadian Folk Music Awards, a new number one CD. And as you said, this new CD has a lot of sitar on it with sitar master Anwar Khurshid. What is it about that particular instrument that excites you?
Well, it's an instrument that, I mean, you hear like one note on the sitar and you're there. You really feel like you've entered a zone. And for us, writing together was a really fun process because Anwar would play one song for like an hour and he's still warming up. But us, we like to think about our Western audiences and keeping things short and punchy. So we found a really neat middle ground when we were recording that project. And there's just so much to learn from all the music around the globe. Like everyone who plays traditional music or folk music from a different country has a whole wealth of knowledge that they bring to the table. But the other thing was that there were some songs that I was astonished that we knew together in common, like Anwar had actually learned Blowing in the Wind back in his home village. And I said, well, we have to do kind of a Bollywood version of Blowing in the Wind for our audiences. So that's a lot of fun.
And his music, by the way, we need to point out, it was featured in the Oscar-winning film Life of Pi, among other interesting movie collaborations. But this is a live show. This will be next Wednesday night at Mudville Music Room. That's at 3105 Beach Boulevard in Jacksonville. They do live shows just about every night at Mudville. This is sure to be a really cool show. They are Canada's own Sultans of String. Get your tickets now at raylewispresents.com. Band leader and violinist Chris McCool on the line. Hope you enjoy your time down here in Florida, Chris. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. See you there.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have feedback about the show, we always want to hear it. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our podcast. Download it at iTunes or the WJCT app. Next on 1A, their first weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.